is really fundamentally an American.
No more!
No more!
Broadcasting from the Gulag city of Planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. I'm Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. Our guest for the evening, the creator of druglibrary.org, the source for the documents that were used to promulgate this drug war, Mr. Cliff Shaper. All right, I want to ask you a question. Who loves the drug war? The drug lords, of course. More on that in a minute. Why do they love the drug war? The enormous profits they earn, of course. More in a minute. How do they get these enormous profits? The black market, of course. More in a minute. Why is there a black market? Drug prohibition, of course. More. Why is there drug prohibition? To protect society, of course. And just how do we protect society? By encouraging drug barons to supply, gangs to distribute, and street corner peddlers to sell drugs to our children. So who are the drug lords? Well, besides the obvious barons, gangs, and peddlers, there are the real kingpins, most of whom have addresses in Washington, D.C. The profits to these real kingpins, the CEOs of major banks, the corporate heads that bribe our public officials with campaign contributions to eternalize these drug laws, the bought judges, corrupt government scientists, and other officials who look the other way to validate and continue this everlasting rain dance of the heathens. The black market is no accident. It is exactly the desired result of the drug lords. For without the violence, confusion, demonization, and especially the opportunity to legitimize continued bigotry, this drug war could not last another day. So drug prohibition really exists only to serve the needs of those in power, to maintain a stranglehold over the people and the U.S. Constitution, to assure themselves of an easy supply of bales of U.S. currency. So it is really a group of deviant, lying scoundrels who perpetuate this drugs war, who desire nothing more than that it continue forever. A year ago, I was a voice in the wilderness. Today, I am a concerned, hell damned concerned citizen, and the voices around me grow louder every day as congressmen, authors, organizational heads, and judges join in calling this drug war a hoax, a sham of immense proportion. To tell us about this sham and to explain the history and the hysteria of the drug war, we're going to bring on our guest here in just a few moments, Mr. Cliff Shaper.
Satan is real.
Police officer, open the door.
The former governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson, has done a study which shows that in his lifetime, the U.S. will have arrested more than 80 million Americans for smoking pot.
Marijuana smoking, experts point out, can make a helpless addict of its victim within weeks, causing physical and moral ruin and death. Should you ever be confronted with the temptation of taking that first puff of a marijuana cigarette, don't do it.
A conservative estimate of persons in the United States, both juvenile and adults, who have used marijuana at least once is about 8 million, and may go as high as 12 million. Can you imagine what would happen to the law enforcement and correction system of this country if each of these 12 million people had been caught by a policeman when smoking his first marijuana cigarette?
Is she dead?
Not yet. This picture was taken at 10 p.m. The girl lived until midnight. Any questions?
But I maintain the evidence against marijuana isn't in yet.
Well, sir, will you concede that it might be as harmful as alcohol?
Well, all right, but it's no worse.
No, sir, I hope not. Because according to U.S. government figures, between 5 and 6 million people in this country are physically and mentally sick as a result of their use of alcohol. If marijuana possesses only half the potential of alcohol for violence, criminality, accidents, and social degradation, do we need pot?
Having a little trouble getting the phone lines hooked up, so I'm going to read you a little bit of news. Earlier today, we had an occasion to visit Earth 101, and Hitachi Aziz and myself, we discussed this drug war bias with three different guests. One was Gary Bledsoe, the president of Texas's NAACP, Then we had the chance to visit with Clay Conrad, who's head of the Fully Informed Jury Association. And thirdly, we had a gentleman named Cliff Thornton of efficacy.org. And basically, we determined and presented fact that validates the fact that this drug war is nothing more than a continuation of the Jim Crow laws, of the slavery laws. And I invite you to listen to the show. It is on my website already. It is at www.cultural-baggage.com, and it's near the top left. It's the link to, it says Earth 101. And I appreciate the invite to Earth 101, and we're going to do it again next week. We do have confirmed Jeff Blackburn, the Tulia attorney, and I'm trying to get John Conyers, the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, as well as Lynn Paltrow, who speaks for the rights of pregnant women who have their children taken for drug use. It looks like we do have Cliff online. Hello, Cliff.
Yes.
Hey, good evening, sir.
How you doing?
I'm good. I lost your number, I admit it. And we found it, thanks to my son who broke his knee finding it.
Okay.
All right.
Well, whatever it takes, I guess.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Charlie. Anyway, folks, this is the guy who can provide many of the answers to the questions you might have about the drug war. I don't know how much of my show you're able to catch, Cliff, but I was telling him you're the guy who gathers up all these answers and puts them on the Internet for all of us to use.
Well, I thought it was a pretty important thing to do because... just to give everybody a little background on how I got into it. Years ago, back in the early 70s, when Nixon had his commission on drugs, and there was quite a bit of discussion of it, I went out and I actually read Nixon's commission, and I read a number of the other major works on the subject. And I discovered something very interesting, and that is that U.S. government policy is totally out of phase with what the evidence is. I mean, it's just it's so out of touch that it's just astounding. It's like a modern belief in witchcraft.
Indeed.
And for many years I thought that, gee, the evidence was so clear that sooner or later the evidence would become well known and people would see how foolish this whole thing was, and things would change. But they never did. And you know, finally, we got to the age of the Internet, and I realized that a lot of these books were just getting lost. Like, for instance, Nixon's commission report, I think only maybe 1,000 copies or so were printed, and most of those are basically lost in university research libraries now where nobody can read them. And I thought it was very important just to get the full text of all of those books out on the Internet where people can read them full text, so they don't have to rely on my summary or somebody else's summary of what they said. They can go in and read the full text of the documents themselves. And I started putting up a few of these, and then other people around the world saw what a good idea this was, because otherwise these materials would just basically be lost. And they began to send me other copies of other studies from around the world, and nearly all of them were very rare documents, very difficult to find, even if you're a good researcher and have money to go traveling around to find them. But then I put them on the net, and if you read all of them, it's an astounding story. It's just, it's amazing that this ever happened.
My friend Jerry Epstein, DPFT, calls it a rain dance. Is that a fair summation?
That's a pretty fair summation. I liken it more to burning of witches in the modern age. I mean, it really is. It's kind of a belief in witchcraft, in a belief in things which just aren't true and couldn't be true, and then basing our whole public policy on what is basically mythology. Rain dance, I guess, is a good way to describe it.
Yes. Well, Cliff, I talked to you a bit earlier in the week or last week, and I was wondering, the 152 Democrats that voted not to fund the DEA going after medical marijuana patients, that was kind of a high watermark, and I'm just wondering if you were able to track any history on maybe where it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Oh, 10 or 20 years ago was at about zero.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think we've had a huge shift in the last few years, and I think it is, I would ascribe a large part of it basically due to just simple education. The internet has made the world a much smaller place and made people much more knowledgeable about a great range of things. But 10 or 20 years ago, I think you would have been hard put to find even five members of Congress that would admit to any feelings for reform.
Okay. Cliff, I think I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines early today because, again, you can provide a lot of answers that maybe I'm not aware of the details on. And, folks, I want you to give us a call. Number here is 713-526-5738. Cliff, I just became aware of something the other day. Somebody sent me an email, and it actually says that per federal law, a sentence of death can be carried out on people who grow too much marijuana. And I don't know how much you might want to discuss it, but could you tell us about the situation with your mother and medical marijuana?
Well, my mother was a person who basically was not an intoxicating kind of person. Too much coffee was a bit too much for her, and her limit was a glass of wine. And any more than that, she really didn't like, because she didn't like the effects of it. She just didn't like feeling high. She was the kind of person who really was high on life and got her highs from aerobics and exercise and other things like that. Well, at one point she had a problem with some cartilage on her ribs. It became infected and it had to be removed. And during the course of the operation, the doctors injured some nerves. Now, I don't want to really say it's the doctor's fault, because this sort of injury is fairly routine in surgery. If you do enough surgeries, you'll get a few of them with bad results. And it gave her extreme chronic pain. She said that it felt like the right side of her rib cage was literally on fire 24 hours a day. And she tried many, many things, just everything under the sun, surgery, injections, and what, creams and ointments and pills and whatever else the doctors had. And during the course of this, they stopped her heart twice while they were doing these procedures on her. And at one point, they woke her up by giving her artificial resuscitation, which basically meant pounding on the ribs that were hurting in the first place.
My gosh.
And she woke up screaming at the doctors to kill her, to put her out of her misery. And then as soon as she got out of the hospital, she wrote legal papers saying that if this ever happens again, she was not to be resuscitated because she didn't want anybody pounding on her ribs. Well, after years of trying things, she asked me about medical marijuana and if that would help, and I said, you know, there's really no way to know except to try it. And she found some, and I won't say where she found it.
Okay.
I'll just tell you it's my mother, but I'm not going to tell you where she found it.
Right.
And she found something very interesting. She found that it completely erased the pain. She said it was the only thing she ever found in her life that when she took it, the pain was completely gone. She said morphine and drugs like that would dull the pain and make it easier to manage, but they would not make it disappear. But marijuana made it disappear. Now, just so everybody knows, she was not a fan of marijuana either before or after this happened. And she decided for her own reasons not to continue taking marijuana for the pain because, again, it caused a slight high in her, and she did not like being high. To her, having the pain was better than being high. But I found it quite remarkable that this was the only drug that would completely eliminate the pain. So I know from one person's experience, you know, just one person's experience, my mother's, that there is a medical use for marijuana, and there is a certain set of people for whom apparently it might be preferable to any other drug that's available.
I hear you. I hear you. And I met a lot of people in California who were able to explain to me and show me how that was true for them as well. I really miss San Francisco, Cliff. It was great seeing you out there. And
I had a lot of fun, and whatever they may say about San Francisco, it is a wonderful place to have a conversation in the evening.
Indeed it is. We're going to go ahead and take some calls here in just a second. Steve, do me a favor, if you would, play us track 16. I wanted to hear from Ed Forsh in New Jersey, Weed Man.
I'm here before one of the world's greatest symbols of freedom to let you know the liberty this flag represents is in grave danger. As with alcohol prohibition in the 1920s, the drug war is destroying our free society. Even our First Amendment freedoms of speech and religion have been weakened. Now, saying legalized marijuana in public can result in the government taking away your child. This has happened to me. It's time we return freedom to America by ending the war on drugs. It's really a war on individual liberties, and that's just un-American.
That from Ed Forshin, NJWeedBan.com. Yeah, Ed got himself arrested again yesterday. We'll be bringing him on the news here soon, tell you more about his travails. Okay, I want you to give us a call. We got some folks online, but there's some open lines. I advise you to call early. It's 713-526-5738. Steve, let's go ahead and pick up Randall on line one. Oh, they hung up on him. Sorry, Randall. Okay, well, hopefully he'll call back. But folks, our number here, 713-526-5738. You know, if you get right down to it, Cliff, what you're saying, witchcraft, you know, I mean, it's like a person who takes drugs is suddenly, you know, seen as invincible and bigger bullets are in order. Is that kind of been the progression through the years? I heard today something about they moved from a 32 to a 38 because they heard black people on cocaine were invincible.
Yeah, that was the original reason for the outlawing of cocaine back in 1914. It was the belief that superhuman Negro cocaine fiends, and that's exactly the term that was used, was Negro cocaine fiends, would go on a violent rampage and rape white women and shoot white men. And it was believed that cocaine made them better marksmen. And matter of fact, in one story, they told the story about how one black guy killed five white guys with five shots, and this was taken as proof that cocaine makes them better marksmen. And they also believed that it made them impervious to bullets, which caused police departments across the nation to switch to larger caliber pistols to stop the Negro cocaine fiends. And you see the same kind of a thing today, you know, with the stories about people on PCP and people on crack and the violence it causes and that sort of thing. The modern, I should mention also that that caffeine was almost outlawed at the same time that cocaine was, for exactly the same reasons. It was believed that it had a terrible effect on black men.
My gosh. Okay, we do have some callers back online. Steve, let's pick up Randall. He made it back on line one. Hello, Randall.
Yes.
Welcome to the show. What, do you have a question for Mr. Schaefer?
Oh, sure. One is where the website is, because I would like to be able to read over those materials, since they're so difficult to come by, and you wonder why they would make them so difficult to come by. And also, let's see, I do believe that during the Philippine War, the 45 caliber was introduced because the warriors fighting off the American invasion would work themselves up and perhaps use some kind of drug to dull the pain, and they found that the 38s would empty into them and they'd come up there and kill them and then drop over dead. So the 38s weren't working too well. Yeah. And one last thing. Why aren't those constitutionalists out there saying that this whole drug war is unconstitutional and should never have been made law and is patently against the law, even the one against alcohol had some kind of perverted constitutionality, but this one doesn't. It was just a fiat. And they just decide, okay, we don't like this, or rather our constituents don't like it because we told them so, and I'll listen off the air.
Well, okay, Randall. A bunch of excellent questions here. These go really kind of to to the core of things. So Dean, and please help me out here if I don't answer any of them.
Okay, no, go ahead.
Correctly, but
website.
First of all, the website is druglibrary.org. druglibrary.org. And my particular section of it is the Schaefer Library of Drug Policy, which is listed there at the top. And if you go there, you'll find a collection of the major studies of drug policy, hundreds of original historical documents, all full text, the transcripts of the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act hearings, and hundreds of other documents. But it's druglibrary.org, and look for the Schaefer Library. As far as the there is one question here you brought up that I would like to address, and that's the constitutional issue, because this has kind of an interesting history, because a lot of people would allege that, gee, the Constitution doesn't give the government the right to go interfere with people's personal lives. If you go driving on the street under the influence of some drug, that's a different matter, but why should the government have the ability to raid somebody's home and arrest them because they had a drink of alcohol or a puff off a marijuana cigarette or something like that? And if you study the history of it, the original law that outlawed drugs in the United States was the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914. And even the people who wrote the act agreed that the federal government had no power to prohibit the use of drugs. They felt that, number one, it was a violation of what we might call privacy issues today. And number two, if any authority in the United States was granted that power by the Constitution, it would be the states and not the federal government. So it was a states' rights issue as well. So they knew that a direct prohibition would be probably ruled unconstitutional. So what they did was they framed it as a tax act. And the reasoning goes like this. Does the Constitution allow the federal government to levy a tax? Obviously it does. Does the Constitution allow the federal government to tax anything? Well, there's no real limits placed on what the government can tax. Is there any limit on the amount of the tax? Well, there's no limit on the amount either. So therefore, they reasoned that the federal government, if they put a tax on these drugs, they could make the tax so prohibitive that no legitimate commerce could survive in these drugs. And then they would arrest people for a tax violation, not for possession of the drugs. And that's why the drug enforcement was originally located in the Treasury Department, not in the Department of Justice, where it should have been.
Well, Cliff, we do have a couple more callers. Let's go ahead and pick up. What do we got? Ken on line two. Hello, Ken.
Yes, sir. I have a question.
Go ahead, sir.
I would like to ask him if he has any information on the crimes that's being committed in Central America in the name of the war on drugs, you know, killing innocent civilians and women and children.
I don't specifically, but there is a site that I would recommend for that, and that is Narco News.
That's narconews.com.
Okay. What about the, you know, how the war on drugs finance our prison industry? You know, we have, just like we spend billions of dollars on weapons in the name of different wars, we spend a lot of money on prisons in this country.
Yeah, so that's become a huge problem. In California right now, the biggest political contributors in the state is the Prison Guards Union.
Yes, sir.
So this is a tremendous influence, and of course the people who build these prisons are interested in building more of them for a profit. Let me see. I don't have a lot of information on that subject, but I might suggest, Dean, do you know a website just offhand that covers that one pretty well? I think November.org might.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed, November.org. Cliff, we do have one of the seven surviving medical marijuana patients online who has a question for you. I think this is George McMahon.
Hello, George, yes.
Hello, George.
Yes, George, I'm not a surviving medical marijuana patient. You must have got me confused.
Oh, okay. I thought you're not from Manville?
I am from Manville, but somebody got confused. I've never smoked marijuana in my life.
Well, go ahead, George.
But I just wanted to make a quick comment relating back to Randall's call. He asked the question about why aren't the strict constitutionalists raising a hue and cry. And actually, anyone who's familiar with the libertarian philosophy understands that the strict constitutionalists in this country are on your side. We definitely would like to see the laws against the consumption. Let's put it this way. We're against government dictating what you put in your body, whether it's marijuana, fat, soda water, or whatever. And it's a very strong plank in the Libertarian Party. Just thought I'd throw that comment out and see if you can go grab the guy that's surviving medical marijuana patient. Okay?
Thank you, George. Okay,
you.
Steve, let's go to Anthony, line one. Hello, Anthony.
Hello.
Yes, sir. A question or comment? Make it quick, please.
I have a comment and a couple of questions. One thing I'd like to say, there appears to be a lack of hello?
I'm sorry,
I don't know where that's coming from.
Steve, hang up three. Oh, heck, we lost him. I'm sorry, sir. We got to be quick. Pick up Mike, line four. Hello, Mike.
Hi, yes.
Real quick.
I was wondering if you knew about Ken Lay's graduate work in the mid-60s at the University of Missouri. He was the darling of a professor named Pinckney Walker. And Lay wrote a thesis on the negative impact of a pullout from Vietnam, and the major implication of that paper was that the Republican program was based upon using war as an economic stimulus. And it's ironic that that's what Reagan did when he came into office, and it's what Bush has done now. So more or less, Ken Lay's economic theory that he's learned in college is what this Republican administration and the drug war is based upon. Could you comment on that, please?
Real quick, Cliff, we got about 30 seconds. Thank you.
Well, I've always felt that the drug war is based primarily on ignorance. Ignorance and a belief in witchcraft. There are various expressions of that, but I think that's what it comes down to. I think it's built on ignorance, and it requires ignorance to survive.
Thank you, Cliff. I see we have Michael out there, and, sir, we just can't get to you today. We appreciate the calls from all the listeners. Folks, this drug war is over the day you say it's over. It's over the day that you dare to stand up and say, you know what, this doesn't make any sense. Just like our friend Cliff Schaefer here. And I want to thank him publicly for making it possible for me to educate myself about this crazy drug war with his website, druglibrary.org. And Cliff, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay, folks, I want to alert you to the fact our guest for next week will be U.S. Representative Ron Paul. And, you know, it's time to call the mayor. You know, I think if you give him a shout and convince him to come on this show and explain to us just why this drug war goes on, we'll all be a lot better off. And so I guess in closing, as I always say, please remember, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag, so please be careful. For my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. KPFT, Houston.